Rough Trade is giving away a third of the first 3 months of the Rough Trade Club plus new music membership exclusively to 101 Part-Time Jobs listeners. Become a member of Rough Trade Club New Music and you'll receive the Rough Trade Album of the Month straight to your door every month on an exclusive vinyl pressing with bonus material. Club members have received exclusive pressings of albums from Sufjan Stevens, Sprints, The Last Dinner Party, English Teacher, and Over Mono, just to name a few, this past year alone. Sign up using the promo code CLUB101POD and you'll get Rough Trade's Album of the Month, Camera Obscura's Look to the East, Look to the West, for a third of the usual price. By signing up, you'll be getting Rough Trade's exclusive issue of the album on opaque purple in a gatefold sleeve, plus a bonus CD containing 5 demos. Don't want the album of the month but still want all the benefits? Sign up to the standard tier using CLUB101POD and you'll still get the first month free. You'll also get free shipping on all orders, 10% off at the bar and on secondhand vinyl in store, and exclusive access to sold out Rough Trade events. So don't hang around. Head to roughtrade.com/club and sign up with the code CLUB101POD. That's CLUB101POD and claim money off Rough Trade's Album of the Month today. This offer is for UK residents only. Do you play in bands? I did for the longest time, and I wish that I knew that DistroKid was a thing. I don't even think it existed back then. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and artists keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. 1 million+ artists rely on DistroKid to get their music on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all the major streaming services. When you get DistroKid, you can see a DistroKid bank and withdraw your earnings. You get notified when you've earned royalties and you can withdraw via the app. And you can even check your streaming stats on Spotify and Apple. Get 30% off your first year on DistroKid by going to distrokid.com/VIP/101pod. 30% off for your first year. That's not bad. We know it's a tough world out there. Why don't you make it easier for yourself? And to get 30% off that free year as an artist, where you get 100% of your royalties and earnings, go to distrokid.com/VIP/101pod. All right, stay with me. I'll be right back after this.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to 101 Part-Time Jobs, where I speak to bands about the jobs they've done, the ones that we don't know them for. And this month is Hassle Records Month. It's their 15th birthday. And to celebrate, they're releasing a bunch of reissues, including 4 Year Strong's Rise or Die Trying. And so I'm asking Alan Day all about those early years, all about the trying times they had later on in their career, and everything in between. And what I really wanted to get down to was the fact that he started a Christmas tree and flower farm, which I think, given his visual appearance and aesthetic, is fucking excellent. If you like this show, don't be shy. Leave a review, rate it, subscribe. I've got a whole lot more brilliant guests to come and I'm excited about it. East London's Signature Brew have been brewing music-inspired beers since 2011. They've made collaboration beers brewed with the likes of Mastodon, Idols, Slaves, Enter Shikari and a whole load of others. And you can order their beers from their website if you're in the UK at signaturebrew.co.uk and get 10% off by using the voucher code 101podcast. That's all capital letters. All right, you're listening to 101 Part-Time Jobs. I'm Giles Bidder, and this is Alan Day from 4 Years Strong. I don't want to be the one to stay. I don't want to be the one that got away. this podcast is all about stories from those early years touring and those that battle between normal life and band life. And you just said that it's still kind of like that.
It is. I mean, some things have changed, you know, over the years. And like, you know, we started in a really shitty van and then we moved on to a little bit better of a van. And then next thing you know, you're on a bus. But like, I don't know, the lifestyle's still the same, like being away from home, being away from your friends and family, like on the grind, showing up every day is the same. You're just at like a slightly different venue, but you have the same basic food options, even though it's a slightly different place. Like, you know, all those bits and pieces have stayed the same, no matter what level of touring you're doing.
I think there's something to say for being at home and sort of going down the road for a coffee just when you want to in your own time.
Yeah, coffee is definitely a lifesaver on tour. Here's what changed touring forever, which is Yelp and Uber. Like it's different in the best possible way. Like in the early days, you're kind of at the mercy of whatever you can see or whatever you can walk to comfortably and whatever direction you happen to decide to walk, whatever, you know, and you just got whatever you got. Like there's McDonald's here, or maybe you're lucky and there's a cool like diner or something. But man, now the first thing me and Dan do when we wake up every day on tour is we Yelp what the best restaurant, the best breakfast you could possibly get in whatever city we're in, and the best coffee with the best ratings. And it doesn't matter how far away it is, because we're just going to call an Uber and go there. Because that's the one thing that keeps us sane, is like making sure we're eating good and getting good coffee and not just like whatever happens to be next to us, you know?
And I guess it's quite like a serious thing is staying sane. I mean, you've been a band for so long now.
Yeah, we sure have. It'll be 20 years next year, 2020.
Wow.
That's saying we've been a band, meaning Dan and Jake and I, Joe, like he was in the band like 3 years less than the rest of us. But we started the band in 2001, but really the like level of touring we started doing and like being gone like for entire years and, you know, being as busy as we were, I guess didn't really start till like 2005. So not fully 20 years of like touring nonstop, but
of course, you know, yeah,
it's still a long fucking time.
2005 is a long time ago, man.
Yeah, it really is.
Before Yelp and Uber. I mean, it's even funny to think of it like that, right?
It was even before like GPSs in a car, you know, like, now who the fuck has a GPS, because you just get it on your phone, the directions. But before it was this like separate thing that you have in your car, and it was like this luxury that not everyone had, and we didn't have one for the first probably freaking 3+ years of touring, and we brought like maps.
And it's something I talk quite a lot about on this podcast, but it's that thing where we've lived through that time of we didn't have social media, and now it's such a It's basically part of everyone's job now.
It really is. It's scary because, I don't know, I use it as an excuse. Like, we started the band and lived through before that existed. And I always use that as an excuse of like, that's why we suck at it so bad. It's because it's new to us. But there are other bands that are freaking great at it and understand. Like, it's crazy that social media has like a total, there's an art to being good at it. And that just blows my mind because I don't understand it at all.
For real. And I have the same thing, just as like a fan or someone who works at a radio station. But I have recently realized that, I mean, you gotta do it. You gotta do it. And you have to just lean into it and try and find your voice.
Yeah, I think that's what's important. It's really like anything else. Is the stuff that works. I mean, sure, there's bad stuff that works too, but I think the stuff that really works is when it's authentic. Like, that kind of goes for fucking everything, you know, like writing a song, it comes across to the listeners like a real thing when it's authentic to who's singing it or to who's writing it or, whatever. And I think that that kind of is the same for social media. Like, if I went on freaking Instagram right now and pulled the like, hey, what's up, guys? Alan from 4 Years Strong here. I'd, you know, smash that like button. You know, that's not who I am. So it wouldn't work. People would look at that and be like, what the fuck is he trying to do? You know, that's not authentic to me or the band. So finding that voice, which obviously we haven't done, because if you see our social media, I mean, it's like, it looks like old guys because we don't know what the fuck to post. But if we tried to be the fucking young influencers, then that wouldn't be authentic either, because that's not fucking who we are.
Maybe there's a market for the slightly jaded person.
There definitely is a market. I don't know. I don't know how you'd pull it off. How do you be jaded but still come, like, I don't know. I feel like it would be like, how do you be jaded and still be doing the content? Because I feel like being jaded means you stay away from it and you don't know how to do it, right? So how do you get both?
You could start with using just lowercase stuff, like the Billie Eilish thing. She's kind of got that young jaded thing.
Yeah, that's true.
But you still have to be kind of good at your grammar, because you definitely like reading books.
Right, right. Well, I don't know. I guess you could, instead of being the like really psyched voice guy that's smashing the like button, you could be the opposite and just, you know, do the same thing in theory, but say like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing here. This stuff is so stupid, but you know what? Like this, I guess.
Yeah. Look, I don't really care, but I'm here because I kind of have to. So fucking don't like it or do, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. Just lean into the fact that you don't know what the fuck you're doing. And
I think we found the voice of 4 Years Strong social media right here.
I think so too.
But it's funny when you say like that kind of, Cause Explains It All, right? I was just listening to Explains It All before hopping on this, and you clearly have a sense of humor. You know, it's in your music, it's in your lyrics, it's in the way that you do things. It's got this, like, you know, that kind of feel of the same way that like the Goonies does, or like coming of age movies. That kind of, that's that American humor that has a certain time in like the 90s. You know,
charmed
life shit.
Yeah, we've always like not liked to take ourselves too seriously, because that's part of why we play in a band, because we want to just fucking have fun and do what we like to do and be who we are. That's why we started playing music, and I think that we try to have that come across, you know, in what we do. It's, you know, in our music videos and stuff, they're very rarely like super serious, and like, it just, that's just not who we are.
And you must have gone through, you know, moments in your career where maybe you've leaned into doing something that did feel weird.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we did a whole album cycle on it.
Which album was that?
In Some Way, Shape, or Form. Yeah, we put out a record, and I don't know. It's kind of a long story of how we got there, but it didn't, long story short, it didn't go well. Fans didn't like it. We kind of realized we didn't even like it, you know, and I think that also stems from people not liking it. I think if it was like a smash hit, we would have been like, cool, yeah, I like this.
Yeah.
But when we kind of put our, it's a funny story, like it did so poorly that it kind of isn't part of our like discography in our eyes, most of it, because we don't play it live, people don't ask for it. And one time we were on tour kind of more recently, and we were like, maybe we should play some more songs off of that. And we put it on our bus. Like, we put it on like the stereo. And I think that was the first time ever, cause we had walked away from it for so long, that as a band, we kind of heard what the listeners heard the first time they heard it. Like, Oh, this is kind of weird. This isn't that good. You know, like I think it was in a integral part of who 4 Years Strong is and who 4 Years Strong has become, because we learned a lot through that whole process as songwriters, as musicians, as people. Mm-hmm. And but yeah, I don't know, I feel like it wasn't that good.
We're all learning, like everything is practicing.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think that's such a thing. And I think that it's never too late to change. And I've gone through my own stuff with my, you know, my band toured in Australia in 2015 and I was just the most depressed I've ever been in my life, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, why now? But you realize that the situation's bad and then you make a change.
Yeah, for sure.
And how long did it take you to come back from that?
Oh man, a couple years. Like that record came out in 2011 and we did a couple tours. The last one being Warped Tour 2012. And we were in like a terrible place as a band, like on a personal level. We all fucking hated each other. We would get off stage every day and like just yell at each other about something and then not to talk to each other for the rest of the day and go off our separate ways. Like it was bad. And then we ended up taking like a couple years off, or a year and a half at least, where we didn't even speak to each other. We all went home and we didn't officially break up, but I had a phone call with Dan one day where we were saying like, yeah, we're probably going to break up. I think we ended up coming back to it because we all had this time at home to kind of reflect and try other things. Like Dan got like a job. I didn't. I just sat at my apartment with my girlfriend, my what now wife, and was just like, I don't know. It started like a typical like movie where she's at work all day and she comes home and I still haven't gotten out of my sweatpants and I've been watching TV, and then it transformed into me trying to find some like spark of inspiration in like different hobbies. Like I was like painting and like trying all these weird things, and my wife would come home from work and I'm trying this new thing and I didn't realize how embarrassing it was until later she pointed out like, yeah, that was rough, like every day coming home like to you just like trying to find something to care about since you don't have the band. And yeah, me and Dan just like, I think we kind of realized that one day and we're like, fuck, we should probably try and write music or something. And he literally like quit his job that day and came over and we started writing music. And that was the start of the next thing we did, which was the Go Down in History EP.
I mean, it's funny to think that at that point you'd been just playing in the band.
It was, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was everything. It was my fucking life. Because, sure, I had a long-term girlfriend. We were living together. I have a family and, I mean, like, parents, not like kids or anything. But that was, at that time, like, as far as time goes, that was a small part of my life. Because I was on tour 10 months a year. And I was with my girlfriend for 2 weeks here and 3 days there and, you know, and living at my parents at that time in between tours. So like,
what would they say about that? Your parents and your girlfriend? I mean, obviously you got married. There's a lot of support required there, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think we as a band were very fortunate to have very supportive, like just like a support system behind us with girlfriends and wives and parents that were just psyched for us. Like, I mean, I know I can speak for myself and this is kind of an assumption, but I think my parents were as supportive as they were because I was such a piece of shit student in high school. And, you know, when I was a junior in high school and I'm skipping class and getting in trouble all the time. And I'm like, hey, I want to go on tour because I have this opportunity. My parents are like, yeah, you have something? Great. Go do it.
Yeah. And you shred. Like, you both shred.
Well, thank you. But
you do. I remember like hearing Rise or Die China. And it's like, wow. You know, like this is next level.
I mean, yeah, we definitely took pride in trying to. At the time, it was a little bit of like we wanted to try and show off, I guess, for lack of better term. Like we knew, like when we were writing Rise or Die Trying, I think it was around then, I could be wrong, but we were listening to a lot of like fucking like Lamb of God and like just like guitar nerdy kind of stuff that we were like, well, man, how can we like incorporate that into what we do? And I remember there are certain parts on the record that there's like a way you could play it that would be like maybe easier for some people, but we liked the idea of like making our fingers look like they were like going fucking crazy. So we did these like really weird versions of chords and like open string and like, I don't know, just like weird stuff that we thought looked cool.
Did you ever think about teaching guitar? Was that a thing that you would want to do?
I don't think so. I'm such a bad teacher. My wife can attest to that. I've tried to teach her guitar and I think I'm bad at it because it comes naturally enough to me that when someone can't do it, I'm just like, no, you just do this. It's easy. I never practiced a technique of strumming. It just kind of happened over time. So I wouldn't know how to explain how to turn something that doesn't happen naturally into part of your movements, you know?
I'm thinking about strumming and thinking about that record. I've never really put this together, but the story so far have got some great tunes. And I think one of the things that makes some of their like best stuff is that kind of like the rhythm and the time signatures, I guess, which you have on that record massively. I mean, you have that as a band.
Yeah. Well, because we always wanted to keep things interesting and keep things as unique as we can. And that's like one element that you can incorporate. It's not just the chords, just the notes, but it's the patterns that you're playing these chords and ways that you lock in with the drums and like how it all interacts with each other. And I think that's something that a lot of bands are doing now. I can't say that was our thing. I mean, we were a big inspiration for that kind of stuff for us. It was like, I don't know if you remember, there was a band called Fairweather.
No, I don't know.
Oh man, they're amazing. The record was called If They Move, Kill Them. And they just had this way of like, they were playing every time they'd strum a chord, the kick drum and the bass would be doing the same thing. So everything was like super locked in and it was like these, not that they were necessarily like coming up with this idea, but that's what we were listening to a lot when we first started the band and started doing kind of the stuff that continues on in our sound. Because obviously there's a lot of stuff that when we started this band is not a part of us anymore. but there are a lot of it that, you know, carries through our the different versions, the different like cycles of our albums and our influences and stuff. There's always stuff that carries over.
Some of those like patterns, some of those records and, you know, those songs, like just the way that a song is played just makes you want to mosh.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the idea, right? I don't know if it's Rick Rubin or someone that I read a quote that was like the number one goal when writing a song or producing a song or whatever, working on music, is to have the listener have a physical reaction to it, right? Even if it's just as simple as like tapping your finger on a desk or tapping your foot or bopping your head, then bring that to the extreme of like being at a fucking concert and you have to like fucking swing your arms around and jump and all this stuff, because it's just like affecting you that much that your body is reacting to it. You know,
that's a good litmus test when you play a new song to a crowd, especially a festival crowd or a band, you know, if you're supporting, where people aren't necessarily there, you know, for you. And you can tell if like one of the new songs you're playing is like good or not.
Oh yeah. And it's really a sad time for obviously everyone in the world. But we put out a new album this year and it was the first time I think in our entire career that the new songs were like the highlight of the set. Like the album came out the first day of the tour. And so it's not like people have been like living with this music. We've always been the kind of band that it takes, you know, the people at the shows, they want to hear their favorite old song, and the new songs take a little time to become their favorite old songs. You know what I mean? So And I think we're definitely not the only band like that. You know, that's, I think that's pretty common, but I always, you know, strived for that, like the new song being what someone is excited to hear when they go to the show. And it was fucking happening. And then all of a sudden the whole world shuts down.
I mean, that must have been so fucking cool to see, though, because 4 Year Strong has obviously been a band for so long. I just want to, like, applaud you for fucking just kicking it.
Thanks. Yeah, I can't believe we've been able to do this as long as we have. But it's pretty fucking cool.
And writing, like, the best stuff that you've written to date.
That, yeah. I mean, obviously that's... I don't know if everyone feels that way, but I sure do. The album we just put out is, I can speak for the whole band when I say it's our favorite thing that we've done probably since Rise or Die Trying or Enemy of the World, or probably ever. And I think there's a lot of reasons behind that. Like, Rise or Die Trying was an unbelievably exciting time in our career, because that was a time in which we were writing music for no other reason but to do something that we liked and that we thought, like, worked. You know, it was we were creating who we were. And there was no expectation, right? Because we didn't really have a following or anything yet. I mean, a little bit, but, you know. So that was an interesting time. And not that we didn't like Enemy of the World. I mean, in hindsight, I like Enemy of the World better than Rise or Die Trying, but the difference between those two albums were Enemy of the World was us, like, living up to and trying to exceed what we had done, like, on a sonic, like a musical, and also on, like, a level of success standpoint, right? Like, we wanted to outdo ourselves. We wanted it to be better. We needed to incorporate the elements that we knew worked about our last album. And like we had already created who we are, and now we were just solidifying it. Right. And then the rest of your career is that. The rest of any band's career is that, is trying to live up to what they know they're capable of on, you know, when it comes to success or whatever word you want to use there, but also giving fans what they expect, but also finding that middle ground of keeping them on their fucking toes and throwing some curveballs and not alienating people. And there's this, like, dance that's going on, this, like, intricate fucking weaving, and, like, you know, like that scene in Mission Impossible, he's going through the fucking lasers, you know, like, that's what it's like when you're creating music as a veteran. I don't know if that's the right word, but a band that's been around, that has a following, you have rules and guidelines almost, you know? And this new album was the first time since that first album that I felt like we were being as authentic as we, like, wanted to be. Like, I mean, it's impossible to go back to having zero expectation and having zero, like, thoughts of not wanting to alienate fans and incorporating these elements and blah blah blah, but this was the first time that I felt like we were focusing more on the authenticity and, like, incorporating influences that were really, like, part of who we are now, while still thinking about, like, the 4 Year Strong that people know.
I think you can hear that. I think there's, like, this energy that is not written somewhere, and you can't define it, but it shows through and it's there. And you know when it's there. And Brain Pain has that.
Well, I'm glad it does, because you have no idea how much, like, creative energy we were putting into this album as we were writing it. Before we even started writing, we were conceptualizing, well, not officially, but just, like, talking a lot about, like, what is the next 4 Year Strong record? I feel like if we're going to do it, it's got to be something cool. And we talked about all these elements that we wanted to incorporate, and, you know, it's really hard to write on the road. So whenever we're on the road, we just do a lot of talking about what we're going to do when we get home, you know? And that was like, we were just doing so much of that and getting all psyched up. And when we actually sat down to write, we came up with the idea of like, well, first of all, we didn't set a time limit. We were like, we're not going to do this until it's right, which is the first time we've ever done that as a band. It's always like, oh, shit, we should probably record a record. Ah, fuck, we booked this tour. We want to make sure the record's out for the tour and this and that, and we need to have a single by this date. So everything kind of has this timeline, and we're notoriously bad. If you ever talk to our like management or agents or label, we're like the worst procrastinators ever. So like if there's a date on the calendar, we will get it done, but we won't get it done until the very last second. And in the past, that always means like, shit, we want 10 songs on the record. Okay, we wrote 10 songs. That's it. And
wow. Any particular record in mind when you say about that? You just write 10 songs for it?
Well, self-titled, the one that came out in 2015, was like one of the weirdest writing and recording experiences we've ever had, because there was no extra material. It was just those 10 songs, and it ended up being 11 because 10 didn't feel like enough, and we didn't feel like we had like the right song. So we just like added Go Down in History from the EP to it. We didn't even remix it or anything. We just put it on. And yeah. And I mean, it was such an extreme that we wrote 10 songs, didn't write a single lyric to the entire record, wrote every detail of every other detail of every song, like all the lead guitars, all the intricacies and the patterns and the, like all the bells and whistles were figured out and recorded before we even wrote a single lyric.
And you both write the lyrics?
Yeah, we write them together, like in the same room, and shoot ideas off each other. And we were in the studio, and Kurt Ballou, who was the producer on that one, we were like we were probably like 4 or 5 days away from recording vocals. Like everything was going to be done. And Kurt kept being like, so have you guys written anything yet? Like, I haven't heard any lyrics. Like, what are we doing? And me and Dan just stayed up all night for the rest of that week and just wrote the entire record worth of lyrics.
That's kind of fucked up.
It is fucked up. And it was so stressful. And I'm kind of amazed that it went as well as it did. And the songs came out as good as they did. And I think, I don't know, this is kind of an airy-fairy way to look at things, but I kind of feel like the songs are in there. It's always a matter of finding the right way to get them out, you know? And I think that's common with a lot of songwriters and like that mentality of like, yeah, you just got to find a way to get that song out of you. So like all those lyrics were real, and I think they would have been written the same in some capacity, whether it took us a year to write it or that 1 week. Like those were the songs that were meant to come out, but it was just like painful to like sit down and be like, okay, like, and like work really hard on like a chorus for the first song, and then be like, oh, that's really cool. We have fucking 9 more choruses to write, and then fucking 20 more verses. And you know, it was very stressful, and I don't know how we pulled it together. But this time around, we did not want to do that. We wanted to spend all the time we needed, write as many songs as we could. And it started to be really, it started slow. Like me and Dan would get together a couple times here and there and write a riff and write a thing. But then we wrote a song. The first one we finished for the album was Get Out of My Head. And it got us so excited about the album because it was the first thing that was like, ooh, this feels like what we hear in our heads as one of the ingredients on this album. And it got us so excited that we were getting together every day and we were writing and just so much stuff. And we made the rule that there are no rules. And we wrote Because again, when we were writing only 10 songs for our 10-song album, everything you write has to be a Four Year Strong song. It has to be something that you can picture being on the album. So if you write a riff and it's like, ah, oh, that's not good, you just instantly throw it away and you start over. Where this time around, we were like, I don't know, fuck it. Let's just, whatever comes to us, let's just see the idea through, even if it's bad or even if it's too far outside the box of what Four Year Strong is. Like, let's just see it through.
Do you think that it fucks with your head that you're, I mean, how long have you been a full-time band? What year? What was the moment that you realized that Four Year Strong was your full-time job?
Oh God, I don't know. I don't know if there was a moment, because our like trajectory of our career was always on like a slight incline. I really can't think of a time where things just like skyrocketed, you know, it was always very, sorry, I got a dog.
What's their name?
I got two. It's Bandit and Kipper. That's Bandit barking right now.
Yeah. Hey, Bandit. He's saying hi, Giles.
Yeah.
Hey, Bandit.
But yeah, I don't know if there was like a moment where I was like, oh, this is what I do now. Because it was always just like each tour was a little bit better than the last one. We were making a little bit more money. We were selling a little bit more records. And yeah, we were just making a hat. We knew it's what we needed to do. Not necessarily we knew that it was what we were doing now, you know, like, so we always found a way to get to that next level.
I asked that question because I wonder if that plays with your mind. I mean, writing lyrics and having that thing where you're like, oh, well, this is what we do, so we kind of have to do it. But in the same amount, it's from, like you say, it's like you're finding a way to get that song out.
But honestly, I'm not like a super spiritual person overall, but like, this album was the first time, like, not the first time. That's making it sound like I had a terrible experience on any other piece of music I've worked on. But like, something was different about this album and the like pride in which, like, so I say we didn't have a deadline, but once we had like a handful of songs that we knew, like, okay, we're in a good place. We know we have like maybe a couple potential singles and this and that. Then we booked a studio start date, which then meant like our label wanted to hear some songs. So there was a couple like soft deadlines throughout the writing process. And the very first one like was basically our label being like, okay, you guys have been working for a really long time. We want to hear something. We know that there's no timeline, but 2 weeks from today, and they put it on our calendars, like, we want to hear the demos that you have. So like, instead of writing more, let's finish these demos. So me and Dan just like hauled ass. And well, when I say hauled ass, I mean, we procrastinated until those last few days before that deadline. And then I just like, I went to Dan's house in his like writing studio, and we just finished these, I think it was 8 songs, which is, they all ended up on the album. Well, no, I think there was one song in that bunch that didn't make the album, but we did record it. But anyway, we had this like batch of 8 songs, I think it was, that me and Dan stayed up until 5 o'clock in the morning, like finishing up these demos, getting them
acoustic.
Like, No. Full, like, we were writing everything in Pro Tools. And like, you know, I was mixing it as we go so that it like sounded like a record. Cause I don't know, we're kind of perfectionists. So when we send something to someone, we want them to get the impression that the way we're hearing in our head. We don't want to send someone something with some element of having to use your imagination to hear what we know is supposed to be there. So it's a skill, being able to hear the potential in something. I think that's why freaking, you know, A&R guys at record labels exist, because they hear something and go like, ooh, I can hear what this could be, you know. Or producers like hearing a demo that's just an acoustic guitar and a vocal and can imagine what this arrangement behind it could be and what the potential in that is. And not everyone has that, and you can't expect people to have that. So that's always my, when I'm going to send someone a demo, I want to send them the most like cheat sheet version of it. Like they don't have to do any studying and anything to know the answers to this test. I'm given it. Here's all the answers. You know it. This is, you don't have to use your imagination. It's all there. And if you hear the demos, compared to the final versions of these songs, they're incredibly similar. Will Putney, who we worked with, did improve upon them greatly sonically. And also there was a couple like crucial like moves that he made, like structurally.
I don't think I'd heard of him before.
Really?
I don't think so.
He's amazing. I mean, he's more in the like metal world, metal and hardcore. But we've known him for years because he was the assistant engineer on Enemy of the World. He was working with the producer Machine. And then he's been off doing his own thing for quite a while now. And we've seen that. We've been following his career and seeing the great thing he's doing. His stuff sounds amazing. So when the idea of him came up for this new album, it was like, yeah. And we had one phone call with him and it was just like, yep, we're going to do that because that sounds awesome. Because he was super excited to, you know, he's an incredibly talented musician and producer that I don't want to say has been pigeonholed, you know, but like he's in that metal world, but he's capable of so much more. And I think he was excited to like step outside that box and work with something more melodic and kind of poppy, but being able to still have a part of who he was in there with like the heavy elements.
And this is your language, right? Because you're a producer. You've produced some great records.
Yeah, yeah. That's like a world that I've been in for a while now. And it's a totally different world from being an artist. You know, it's like literally being on the other side of the fucking mirror. You know, it's like,
do you see that as a job?
Sometimes, but I see being an artist as a job too. I mean, everything you do to make a living is a job because it takes work to be good at something. And sometimes it's not always fun, right? I can't imagine a job that has zero drawbacks to, like, you know, even if it's your favorite thing in the entire world, the second you turn your passion into a career, it has its ups and downs. I don't think there's a way around that.
This podcast is one of my favorite things, but editing it is sometimes not.
Exactly. Yeah, like, so producing records, it's like, yeah, working with an artist in a room and like all the excitement of like writing or, you know, putting this song together and making the arrangement and all that stuff. Yeah, that's fucking amazing. There rarely is a time where that's not fun. But when you gotta, like, I don't know, edit drums and like import session files and, you know,
I think when it's going well, the time just flies, right? And yeah. I think what I sometimes struggle with, and I think it's a human thing, right? It's like being a sundowner, you know, once the sun goes down, you're like, you miss it even though you had it all day. It's like,
yeah,
I find it, I struggle sometimes to like live in the moment and enjoy myself.
Yeah, I try and do my best at all times. I'm like at doing exactly that, like stepping outside of the situation and trying to appreciate what I have, because I think I would be a very, very like hard person to be around if I didn't go out of my way to do that, because the way that I've chosen to live my life is fucking hard. Like, I don't care what anyone says, and I don't take it for granted. I know that I have one of the coolest jobs in the world. But again, that doesn't mean it's not fucking hard and shitty and annoying. And, you know, like when you think about all the being away from, really, the biggest thing is like not being home, not being around the people that you love. And not that the guys in my band are not people that I love. They are, but I also fucking hate them sometimes, you know? And like, listen to me, I sound like an asshole, because it's also the fucking most awesome thing in the world, you know?
But also, I feel like you're made to feel like you should say that, because you have all these amazing fans, you know, that, you know, whose lives you've changed, and they've changed your life. There's this like symbiotic, like beautiful thing here. But, you know, there's always the reality of it. And that's,
yeah, it's a funny thing. And I do, I always try, even when I'm having a fucking terrible day on tour and the show maybe isn't so great, I'm playing bad, or the crowd is like, you know, seems like they don't care. Those are always the moments where I do my best to say, like, okay, shake this off. What's the alternative? Like, would you rather be at home, like working a job that you don't care about, or struggling through the few low points of something that you love, right? So I do try to do that as much as I can.
I sometimes think when I was going to work, where I had to get the tube, you know, the train to work, so, you know, you'd just miss it, right? The doors would stop in front of you, and then, you know, you just miss that train, and like, you're a bit like, fuck, and you see someone next to you like getting infuriated about it, and you're like, ah, don't worry about it, you know, like,
yeah,
it's that kind of willingness, I suppose, to be upset about something.
Yeah, and I think that's like a personality trait thing, really, you know, like my wife will say that, like, it's super annoying how like easygoing I can be because, like, I don't know. It's not that I don't care about things, but it's that I like try to see things in the most positive light as possible. Right. Like, or I don't know, not seeing everything as like the worst thing in the world. Right. Like that you miss the train you're supposed to get on. Like, what is like screaming and crying and throwing a tantrum about it going to do for you? It's literally going to do nothing. Right. And, you know, I know people, my wife included, I don't know if she'll get mad at me for saying this, but like, if you're like doing something and it's like physically, you're trying to do something with your phone and the phone's like freezing or not that, and or not doing what you wanted to do, and you get frustrated and you throw it, like, and I'm always like, what did you get out of that? Breaking your phone so it never works again? Like, you know, I don't see that mentality of like, I don't know, getting over angry. It just,
I don't think
make,
I've ever punched
make
a
sense
wall.
To me. No, I haven't either. No way. I couldn't imagine what it would feel like to be mad or stressed, because that's got to be more than just anger, right? That's got to be like a built up amount of aggression. That's like things have been happening, and it, like, similar to what I was saying about music before, it affects you enough to get a physical reaction, like for emotions to turn into physical reactions. Like, again, this is just me, but it would take so much for that to happen.
But isn't that interesting that you don't, you know, you wouldn't do that normal day to day, but then when you're playing music, or when I presume that you've moshed in your life, that when you hear that song, that you'd go fucking apeshit, you know? That's this magical thing about hardcore or metal or rock, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've definitely had physical reactions to music in that sense, right? Like, I'm a young kid at a show, like, and I just need to like fucking jump off the stage and start like walking all over people's heads. Like, yeah, I've been there, and that's one version of it. But hell, I've even been on the other end of it, where like I'm fucking at a show and I start crying because the music is so fucking good, you know?
Wow.
And
Who are you seeing?
The time specifically I'm thinking of was fucking Tom Petty, one of my favorite artists of all time. Yeah. And it was, I think it was as powerful as it was specifically because it was Tom Petty, not necessarily because the music moved me in any particular way. I mean, it did, but I think it was, again, that built up emotion where like I've been literally living my entire life growing up on these songs that I've heard so many infinite times, right?
Yeah.
And never seeing the fucking, this guy in the flesh playing these songs right in front of me. There was just something powerful about that. Like,
there's something about Tom Petty that transcends all this different stuff for me. You know, it just transcends this. I've got, me and my girlfriend have got matching Tom Petty tattoos of his like face with the hat from the Don't Come Around Here No More video on like a squirrel's body. Thought that'd be kind of funny.
I know. I need to get a Tom Petty tattoo. It's like one of the one music tattoos that people that know me might assume I would have because of how obsessed with him I am, but I don't.
And so what year was that when you saw him?
That was 2009 or 2010, maybe.
He looked so well until.
Oh my God, he looked so good, and he sounded so good. The band was like fucking incredible, and like, I don't know. I took a lot away from that performance because like Mike Campbell, the guitar player, was never like even as big of a fan as I was listening to the records. He never like blew me away as a lead guitar player until I saw it live and I saw what he was capable of, and it blew my fucking mind. And then that's when I got an appreciation for his simplicity in the records, is because like, he was doing exactly what he needed to do and not a fucking ounce more, because if he did more, it wouldn't be adding to the songs. It would be taking away, you know.
The documentary is great. I feel you see that in the documentary.
Yeah, that Running Down a Dream.
Yeah, long one.
It's like 4 hours. Funny story. Right when me and my wife started dating, somehow we ended up watching that at my parents' house with my parents. And she's not really a movie watcher. Like, she's like a, you know, falls asleep during a movie and doesn't really care, looks at her phone, whatever. Doesn't get like invested in movies easily, the way I do. And she somehow got dragged into watching this documentary, and no one knew that it was 4 hours long. It was like right when we started dating. It was with my parents, so she couldn't like, you know, fall asleep or like, you know, go do something else.
Great.
Yeah. But it is a great documentary.
Alan, we've got to right of the end of this hour long podcast. I've saved the good stuff. Well, the job stuff is not a part-time job, is it? You running a Christmas tree farm. That's a full-time job.
No, is it? Believe it or not, it's very part-time. I think that's why it's such a cool, crop, Christmas trees, because the scale that we're doing it at is like, I mean, there's Christmas tree farms that 100% are full-time jobs that have like hundreds of acres. But we have a pretty small operation where we only have like a couple thousand trees in the ground right now. And it's like, you just kind of like checking on them every once in a while. There's things you do at certain times every year, like planting and pruning and all that. But yeah, I mean, because it's here at our home, we just like pop in and say like, oh, we need to mow the weeds in between the trees. All right, we'll spend a day. We'll do that.
So you don't live on it?
No, I do live on it. Well, I mean, it's right across the street. I own two properties, but they're literally across the street from each other. So
were you and your wife like, this is something that's a good hobby that requires a lot of, you know, what was the concept behind it?
Well, it didn't start as a farm. It started, it's kind of a long story, but I found out a buddy of mine was going to be selling Christmas trees as like a part-time gig for the holidays. And I was like, that sounds fucking awesome. I love Christmas. Anyone that knows me that growing up or now knows that I'm a Christmas freak. So I was just like, that sounds awesome. Like helping people pick out Christmas trees and being out in the cold. I love the winter. I love the cold weather. It just sounded awesome. And funnily enough, it was during that time that I told you about, where I was living in an apartment in the city and my wife was working and coming home to me in my sweatpants, trying all these hobbies. But one day she comes home from work and I had done some research that day about like, how do I get a job selling Christmas trees? And there wasn't anything because it was like September and, you know, whatever. But there was lots of information on how to start selling Christmas trees on your own, like opening a business. And it seemed relatively easy and relatively like low startup cost. And she comes home from work and I'm like, so hear me out. I want to like open a Christmas tree lot where we like rent out a parking lot and buy like hundreds of Christmas trees from a farm, and I'll stand out there all day and I'll sell them. And fully expecting her to say no, and she loved the idea, and we started working on it right away. And that was, we did that the first year. Fuck, when was that? That had to have been 2013, 2012. And yeah, we just bought like, I think we bought like 400 Christmas trees, and a truck just like showed up, dropped them off. Dan helped me actually build like a shed that I was going to be hanging out in. And
did it ever stop being funny, the idea of it?
Oh, it was never funny to me. I was like fully in on this is the most important moment of my fucking life. You know, it's all come down to this. And yeah, from there, we just had so much fun with it the first year. And then we were in the city at the time, like near Boston. And then we bought our first house the following year, which was closer to Worcester, which is where I'm from, which is like an hour away from Boston. And we decided to move the operation to Worcester. And then we did it there for 5 years. Every year we would sell trees. And as we did that, and we loved it, and we loved the people we were meeting, and, you know, customers that were coming back every year, it was just like a really fun thing to do. And that turned into like, man, it would be really cool to have our own farm. Like, and people always assumed, I don't know if it's the beard and the like overalls that I would wear, but people assumed I went into the woods and I cut down all of these trees myself, you know, even though I had a truckload of them dropped off here. So it started to be something that I wanted. People were assuming that that's who I was. So like, fuck, is that who I should be? You know? And so as people were like, did you grow these trees? I started saying like, no, but eventually I will. Right. So it turned into this thing that was like, that's part of the plan. Now we've been selling Christmas trees, and we got to start selling our own Christmas trees. And out of nowhere, a friend of a friend, kind of, again, a long story, was selling a farm, and we had just bought a house 2 years prior, and we were not in any position or we had not been thinking about moving or selling our house or whatever, but we're like, fuck it, let's go check it out. And we saw this property, and you know, we just loved it, even though it was disheveled and needed a lot of work, and we just liked it. And it started as like, well, we're going to go grow Christmas trees here. But then we bought the place, and my wife had also planned on doing a flower farm. And that was going to be a big part of it, which it still is. And then as we started to grow the flowers and stuff that first year and kind of envision what the operation was, then we realized we didn't have enough room for Christmas trees. So we had to buy another piece of property across the street. That's just 10 acres cleared that we can grow Christmas trees in. And so now we got this whole thing where we got flowers and Christmas trees.
Do you plant seeds or do you buy baby Christmas trees to plant?
We buy, they're called transplants. So they're like anywhere from like 6 inches to like 18 inches tall, depending on how old they are, that are grown in like, at a nursery in like a transplant bed where they're all close together and, you know, not spaced like a Christmas tree farm would be. And then, yeah, we transplant those into the
ground. And they're quite cheap.
Yeah. They're like a couple bucks a piece, like anywhere from like $1.25 to, you know, $3 depending on their size. but I mean, then it takes like fucking a foot a year to grow after that. So when you're getting like a 7 foot Christmas tree, really it's probably almost 10 years old because that those years in the transplant bed, like we'll get a tree that's 4 years old basically. And it's fucking not even a foot tall, but it takes a long time from seed to grow. And then when we plant it, then it's a foot a year. So it takes a really long time to grow Christmas trees. So I get mad when people complain about the prices. Yeah, I know it's just a tree that you're only going to have in your house for a few weeks and then throw out, but there's so much care that goes into growing them and so much time and energy. And, you know, every year we clear land, we cut down trees, we process the land, we grow a cover crop, we plant the trees, we prune the trees, we, you know, we mow the weeds every couple weeks throughout the summer. I mean, there's so much work that goes into it over the years, and so many that die and you have to plant another one, and there's so much time for things to go wrong. And so just so much energy that goes into growing that one tree. So when it's like $3 more than you hoped to spend, it's like, come on.
What was going to happen when you were going to go away on tour?
What do you mean?
Were you going to get a friend in to look after them?
No, my wife just does it.
It's a one person job, is it?
I mean, it shouldn't be, but we make it work. my parents will come over and help like mow in between.
And they must love that.
Every once in a while. Yeah. Yeah. They have a good time. And my wife has a couple people that work here on the farm, mostly for the flowers.
Cool.
Yeah.
Amazing.
We definitely keep ourselves busy. That's for sure.
Where can people check that out, Alan, if they're in the area? What website?
Is there a website? Yeah, Bellbrook Farm, Bellbrook Farm, M-A, as in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
.com.
Great. We got to plug that in there, man.
Yeah, and there's a Bellbrook Farm Instagram, you know, we got the whole thing.
I'm going to check that out, even though I live thousands of miles away.
Well, you can still appreciate it. That's what's great about the internet. You can basically you can feel like you know it. You know, like I follow people that I feel like I know because I see what they're freaking doing every day. You know, whether it's like some producer or engineer that I like, or some farmer or some, you know, whatever. I don't know if I can know them, but I literally every day see what they're up to.
Right.
So like you feel like you know these people, but you don't. It's kind of weird and like stalkery, but hey.
But it's cool, you can get inspired by it.
Yeah. Well, I feel like it's a fine line between being inspired and being discouraged by not achieving what other people are capable of achieving.
It
depends on how you look at it, you know. Right. Sometimes I look at shit and I'm like, fuck yeah, I can do that, and you go out and you get something done. But other times you look at stuff and you're like, man, fuck, how are they doing that, and I'm just like fucking sitting here staring at them doing it.
It doesn't work.
Yeah. It's a weird world.
Alan, thank you so much for coming on 101 Part
2. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Fuck yeah. Well, I hope to visit Massachusetts at some point, and I'll hit you up.
Please do. I'll have you prune some Christmas trees.
I'd love to do it. I'm there. All right, thank you so much.
All right. I've been working all day, bumming my head on the side, running around.
This is a Mighty Moon Media podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.